All right, we're ready to kick off today's session officially. Today's first speaker is going to be Dave Becker. Dave Becker, Dave, give me just a second. Dave is a geologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Environmental and Munitions Center of Expertise. Dave has a total of 35 years of experience in the environmental restoration field with U.S. ACE. And his focus areas include in-situ remediation technologies and remedy optimization. He is the primary architect of the Corps' remediation system evaluation optimization process. He has participated in well over 60 optimization studies for Army, Air Force, EPA, DOE, and NASA over the past 20 years. With that, I would like to hand it over to Dave. You may start your presentation.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Cindy. I hope everybody can hear me okay. It's certainly my pleasure to speak with you all today, especially about a topic that's very near and dear to my heart, and that's remedy optimization. And so I'm going to talk a bit about the history and evolution of remedy optimization among some of the federal agencies, and then spend most of my time talking about some of the lessons learned and observations that I've had over doing these kind of optimization studies for 20 years. And then I'll sort of put on my visionary hat and kind of look into the future and identify some issues and trends that I think are going to be important for remedy optimization going forward. Cindy, my computer's lagging a little bit. I hit the forward button and it's spinning for me. I'm presuming that you can see my slide on the presentation overview. Just kind of a roadmap where we'll be going today. I'll start. Was that Kirby?
Yes, I'm seeing it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Kirby. I'll start with a definition of optimization and talk about the history and evolution of federal optimization protocols and approaches. And then, like I said, spend most of my time talking about some of those lessons learned and observations. And I've categorized them by six categories that you can see there on the slide. Then I'll finish with those future trends and prognostications that I'd like to have. So I'm going to, hopefully you're advancing here when I press the arrow key. Anyway, always a good place to start is with a definition of optimization. And I've shown here, you know, one definition that I particularly like, and it's largely taken from the EPA definition of optimization. And it's really anything that we do to identify and make happen efforts to improve the effectiveness and cost efficiency of the remedy that we're responsible for, including trying to speed its attainment of closure or the endpoint. And so you notice that it really doesn't say we're trying to find the optimal remedy. What we're trying to do is improve the remedy. And so we're really trying to get to the good, maybe not necessarily the optimal. And that's okay because, you know, in a lot of cases, the optimal solution for anything is like right on the verge of failure. And so maybe the good is actually a little bit more robust than perhaps the optimal. But the take-home point is that when I talk about remedy optimization, I'm talking about a process that tries to improve what we're doing. And it's not a one-time shot, that it's a multiple-time shot. So we'll go now to the next slide and just want to kind of talk a little bit about the history for remediation optimization among the federal agencies. And we have a long history of cooperation, collaboration among the agencies, EPA, the DoD services, DOE, and it's been very, very productive, I think. Early on, when we started talking with each other and realized that we were all kind of working towards the same goal, we actually even, this is late 90s, early 2000s, invited representatives from some of the other agencies or services to participate in some of the studies that we were actually doing. And, it led to, you know, some long-term friendships among the people involved. And I still consider a lot of friends from that kind of effort. But that gave us the opportunity to cross-pollinate and share good ideas and to, you know, identify tools that were really useful for optimization. And it actually culminated early early on with a couple of optimization conferences, one in 1999, the first one, and then another in 2004 that was kind of a follow-up, that brought together not only the federal agencies, but also people from the state agencies, from the private sector, consulting world, everybody talking about things that were related to improving our remedial approaches and that. And those were very good conferences. And I should point out that I've provided some links to the proceedings for those conferences, as well as for a number of other references and guidance documents I talk about in the presentation. If I can go on to slide five. Beyond the earliest part of the 2000s, we started to evolve a little bit with our optimization, and one of the first critical things was the development through the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council of a remediation process optimization team, or RPO team, back in 2003. And a number of the federal participants in optimization, you know, were part of the team, as well as some very talented people from the states, particularly New Jersey, Georgia, California, and then a whole bunch of talented people from the private sector and academia that got involved, and we prepared some guidance on conducting remediation process type optimization. And as part of that, you know, the clear consensus came out of some commonalities for all optimization approaches, including the need for an independent expert team to do the optimization. A fresh set of expert eyes, basically. Another key point was that the optimization should look at all aspects of the remediation, you know, everything from the technical details, dosages of chemicals or operation of pumps and electrical usage, to the reporting, to the monitoring and analytical, to the project management, to the contracting approach even. So very holistic look at different ways that we can improve things. And then the reviews should be balanced, and it shouldn't all be about cost. It shouldn't be, you know, just trying to save money. It should be a matter of improving the effectiveness as well as reducing costs. And there's a balance there, and that was very important that everybody recognized. So anyway, that was a great effort, and the guidance, I've got a link available for that guidance. Beyond that, there were additional collaborations with the federal agencies. The EPA and the Corps of Engineers collaborated on preparing some guidance on long-term monitoring optimization back in the mid-2000s. EPA, the Navy, and the Corps of Engineers collaborated on some DOD-funded demonstration projects for monitoring optimization, as well as transport modeling optimization tools that were very successful. So, you know, again, the collaboration, you know, proceeded and evolved over time. And now going on to slide six here, I hope that's what you're seeing. Anyway, there was continued evolution of the optimization approaches in the late 2000s and into the current decade. It certainly became obvious to folks that optimization extended beyond the post-construction operating remedy kind of focus that had been there. That was sort of the focus early on, things like the triad approach for optimizing your site characterization effort, you know, was really part of the optimization family. There was a recognition that there should be an exit or closure strategy for these sites, that, you know, the roadmap of how to get to where you want the endpoint to be for your particular site. And there was a fact sheet that was prepared by the ITRC Remediation Process Optimization Team on making exit strategy documents. And so that's a good reference. Another recognition was that there should be a evaluation of the conceptual site model. And this is really, you know, kind of validates the need for an independent team to look at this stuff, because a fresh set of eyes can often come in, look at the data, develop a conceptual site model that doesn't necessarily take for granted some of the things that maybe the project team was, you know, looking at and just assuming. And, you know, maybe change the way we view the site, and that often makes a big difference in the performance of the remedy and the cost of the remedy the success of the remedy, bottom line. Matter of fact, looking at the conceptual site model became a fundamental part of the EPA and Air Force in particular, their optimization approaches. So there was this evolution to look at optimization throughout the life cycle of the remediation project, from characterization to remedy selection to design to construction and on into remedy operation farther down the road. And EPA has certainly taken that to, a very high level, and you're going to hear more about that from Kirby Biggs. One other thing that really came up since the middle of the 2000s was, particularly in Department of Defense, was this real emphasis on conducting or contracting with what's called performance-based contracts, where rather than telling the contractor what and how to do stuff, you would tell the contractor what you want to end up with, what your goals are, within the time frame of the contract, and leave it to the contractor to use their own innovation, their own innovative thought to come up with an optimized approach to achieve those endpoints. And then there would be some metrics to monitor their performance. That really changed the way optimization, was really kind of looked at, because now rather than having an independent team coming in from the client side, you really were putting the emphasis of optimization on the contractor. And we'll talk more about, how that's kind of played out here in just a little bit. So if we can go now to slide 7. I want to shift gears now and focus on these lessons learned and observations. And, the first thing I want to start with is the good news. And that is that the optimization efforts, both at the federal level, and I'm sure at the state level, and even for, private clients with their consultants, is that we are having an impact. What we have found, over the recent years is that the project teams that we interact with are very well aware of some of the new technologies, some of the optimization approaches, and some of the optimization tools. So our tech transfer efforts, with webinars like this and others that EPA and the ITRC sponsor, are really having an impact. And that's good news. Another thing I run across with the project teams is that many of them have internal processes to conduct optimization at the grassroots level, I like to call it. And so they periodically actually do brainstorming sessions and look at, maybe even bringing in some fresh people from within their organization or others within the consulting firm to actually do the brainstorming to think about ways to improve it. And I'm all for that. This shouldn't have to be a top-down kind of thing. So that's a good news item. I would say that the most common type of optimization conducted, in my experience, by the project teams has been monitoring optimization. The word's really gotten out there on that in terms of looking at the monitoring frequency, location network, analytical methods, sampling methods, all those kind of things have, people have really picked up on that. That's good. Another good news story, and this is true going back to the early days of optimization, is that in my experience, those people, the operators and others who are responsible for operating active remediation, are generally very well qualified and very diligent in doing what they need to do, and that most of the sites that we visited have been well maintained. And I can certainly tell you some entertaining stories about a few exceptions to that, but by and large, I've been impressed with the people who are responsible for operating the remediations. And then lastly, and probably the most important good news, is that many of the recommendations from optimization studies that have been done, that I've been involved with, many of those recommendations have been implemented, and that real cost savings and real improvements in effectiveness and protectiveness have been recognized. And that's the bottom line. Kind of an interesting sidelight. Just yesterday, I was looking back at actually two optimization studies at a site that I had done previously. I was looking at those recommendations doing another optimization at the same site 8 years after the last one to see, what they've done. And a lot of the recommendations have been implemented, and I think that was very gratifying to me. So we'll go on now to slide 8. And now I'm going to get into some of the other lessons learned topics here. And the first category I want to tackle is what I call technological issues. And I think one of the big things that I've noticed now is that for the larger remediation systems that have long-term active remediation, pump and treat, SVE, that, you know, a lot of these systems have been out there for, you know, 10, 20, even 30 years, and some of the equipment is approaching, you know, their design lifespan. And so we're dealing with aging infrastructure. And so the nature of our optimization is really now starting to look at what makes sense to replace, you know, in terms of the equipment, or is it a good point in time to actually think of doing something completely different? So the economics are different, and that's something that needs to be considered. Another technological change over the last 15 years is this dramatic shift from active traditional remedies like pump and treat to in-situ remediation technology, so that a lot of the sites that we now do optimization studies on have had some kind of in-situ remediation technology applied. The problem is that our implementation of some of these injection technologies, you know, with different amendments, have been less than perfect. We have some successes. We have quite a number of failures. And so we have some ways to go at improving our understanding of these in-situ technologies, particularly delivery systems. Either we're not getting good contact between the amendment and the contaminant, or we're not providing enough amendment, or, you know, it's, you know, just other kinds of mechanical failure kind of issues. And so I'm happy to note that the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council has a new team this year that's been very active at developing guidance on optimizing injection type technologies for remediation. And hopefully that will help address that need. There's been, you know, an evolving recognition that at many sites it's going to take a very, very long time to attain some type of aggressive cleanup goal, some very low levels. And so the recognition now is that, you know, it may take a treatment train, a temporally variable, you know, or evolving application of different technologies in sequence in order to most economically, you know, bring the site closer to closure. And usually we end up with some phase of monitored natural attenuation. This typically involves some type of perhaps aggressive source treatment or some other mechanism to greatly diminish the mass discharge or mass flux from the source area that makes other technologies, including monitored natural attenuation, more feasible and economically viable. And so the real word nowadays is to have, you know, some multiple technologies applied at these sites, and that recognize that it's going to take some time. And then one other issue that I'd like to bring up that's kind of a pet one of mine, and that is some of the sort of what I hate to call it a flaw, it kind of is, with our feasibility study approach. And usually in looking at a lot of feasibility studies, the authors present the different technologies as having an equal likelihood of attaining whatever goals you have, when in reality, different technologies give you different degrees of certainty of attaining those goals. There are some that have a higher likelihood of attainment than others. And unfortunately, usually those that have the higher likelihood also cost more. But by basically saying that all the technologies have an equal chance of attaining the endpoint, the decision makers end up making the decision strictly on cost, when in reality there's a trade-off between cost and certainty. And so maybe for a modest increase in cost, we could buy a significant increase in certainty of attainment. And particularly where property transfer or other considerations come into play, that may be important to the decision maker. So that's something I think we can do a little bit better job on. So go now to slide 9. The next category are characterization issues, I like to call them. And this is a big one. Of course, I'm a geologist, so this is important to me. But I certainly have found that a lot of times the conceptual site model has not really been updated, and it doesn't in some cases take into account the, you know, some data gaps on the actual extent of contamination. It doesn't consider perhaps some other exposure pathways that may exist, most notably vapor intrusion. I think that there's, you know, again, some complacency that maybe some project teams have, and they don't take the opportunity to integrate new information to update the conceptual site model, and that's where optimization can really help. This certainly is a validation for the need for the expert team to take a look at this stuff. And, you know, the net result of not having a good conceptual site model, not having complete site characterization, is you often pay a penalty in cost and performance. And so by addressing these kind of things, we hopefully can improve both cost and performance. So in particular, the teams need to be encouraged to look at what operational data tells you about your system and update your conceptual model accordingly and adapt. One of the things that help us now that's available and I see increasingly used is high-resolution site characterization methods. Direct push technologies, membrane interface probes, laser-induced fluorescent probes, those kind of tools in the last 20 years have really helped us do a better job of characterizing particularly the vertical distribution of contaminants, and the lower cost helps us have a better network to address the distribution laterally as well. So that has helped us make better decisions and optimize some of these remedies after the fact. That should hopefully cut time off the duration of these projects. One last thing in terms of characterization is I still see sites where the project teams have not considered some of the emerging contaminants. I still see sites where trichloroethane is present and they haven't looked for 1,4-dioxane, or where there's some firefighting training or something where the perfluorinated compounds have not yet really been evaluated yet. So that's an area where maybe we still need to do some technology transfer. So if we go to slide 10 now, I want to talk about what I call people issues. And one of the things that's important with optimization is that the optimization team needs to approach the study with great respect and tact towards the project team, because there's a natural, you know, sort of apprehension on the part of the project team. They kind of view it as an audit, you know, and maybe there's going to be negative consequences for them. But really, we have to be very positive, forward-looking. Doesn't matter how we got there, let's all work together to try and move it forward. That should be the attitude with that. And we should reassure the project teams that it's normal to have to modify our remedies. I mean, things are going to change, and we have to adapt to that. Matter of fact, the real buzzword nowadays is adaptive management, and that's really what we want them to do. So changing stuff is not an admission of failure. It's just a natural consequence of our progress towards closure. Another people issue has to do with how to motivate them to implement the recommendations that the optimization study may make. And what we have found, at least from a programmatic level, is that having some means of following up with the project team, usually involving people from higher management or higher headquarters, is a good motivation for them to take the recommendation seriously, usually maybe a year or two after the optimization study, just to follow up to see what they've done. That goes a long way. But these recommendations also have to be backed up with the commitment of providing funding to implement them by management or the clients. There is a responsibility on the part of the optimization team to provide realistic estimates for implementing the remedy. If they're way off, the project team could make bad decisions about whether it was cost beneficial to actually implement the remedy. So good estimates on the part of the optimization team are important. One last people issue, and maybe it's just because I'm getting old, but I see that a lot of the folks that I know that have been very involved in the optimization field are nearing retirement age, and I have not seen as many young people coming in behind or being, you know, mentored to sort of take our place. And so I'm a little worried that the sort of experts that, you know, that we have now are going to retire, and we may not have a pool of people that can comprise those independent teams. Let's go to slide 11 now. One other issue category is with contracting, and I mentioned the performance-based contracts before. Again, this is where we've moved the optimization responsibility onto the contractor, but there's you know, been difficulties at some of the sites I've looked at where the contractor has implemented a technology that is not performing as well, and they're getting to the end of the period of performance of the contract, and you know, the customer, in most cases for me anyway, the Department of Defense, is going to end up with something that is not what we really wanted to end up with at the end. And so, you know, inheriting additional liability at the end of the contract that we didn't anticipate is you know, disappointing to say the least. There's been maybe a poor job at writing our objectives and metrics on the part of some of the federal agencies. We're still learning how to do that. I think we still have a ways to go in my experience with that. And in a lot of cases, the decision about the contractor to do the work has been made a lot of times only on cost without really looking at that technical risk or uncertainty that I mentioned before. The independent optimization still has a role where performance-based contracting is done. The independent team can come in and evaluate the likelihood that the contractor is going to meet the performance goals at the end of the contract. They can also identify options that may seed ideas by the contractors to make better proposals on the next contracting round. So there's still a role, I think, for the independent optimization to be done. And there are other incentives to optimize besides performance-based contracts, cost sharing of savings and those kind of contract, you know, sort of a value engineering cost saving sharing might be a way to do some of the same kind of things. So if we go now to slide 12, the last category is related to exit strategy. And I mentioned how that's important to have, but there aren't many good examples to share out there. I mentioned the ITRC fact sheet on exit strategies, but there aren't a lot of examples to share. I would point out that there's a couple of documents that the Department of Energy, specifically Pacific Northwest National Labs, have prepared, one on soil vapor extraction, another on pump and treat. These are transition and closure guidance that basically lay out some decision logic in order to take the active remediation from where it is to where you want it to be kind of thing. And that would really support some exit strategy development. There are links to those documents provided with this training course. Certainly, our decision documents or records of decision or permits need to account for this adaptive management, the sequential application of different technologies, or even the application of a contingency technology if something doesn't work. We need to have the flexibility to do that to avoid some of the costs associated with the administrative changes that would be necessary in the case of a non-flexible decision document. We also would like to see, I think, more flexibility in setting what our ultimate end goals are, recognizing the site conditions. But that is a somewhat controversial topic, and you know, that, you know, is something that would probably have to be worked out site by site. One last thing in terms of the exit strategy is that the management, whoever is responsible for paying for this stuff, really needs to make it clear what their overall programmatic strategy is. Because I always say, you can have a cleanup that's fast, you can have a cleanup that's cheap, but you can't have it both ways. Usually it's either fast or cheap. And so, you know, some management may want to delay expenses, you know, push more costs out into the future to minimize their outflow of cash now. Others may want to get it off the books as quickly as possible for property transfer or for closing out environmental liabilities on their balance sheet or whatever. But that has to be made clear to the project team. That has to be made clear to the optimization team. So there's that needs to be maybe clarified in a lot of cases. Because, again, there is a trade-off, you know, in costs and benefits with these kind of things. One thing that I'll point out that I struggle with on a lot of sites is that there's a trade-off, like I say, you know, in the effort and the effort that's applied to more aggressively trying to remediate the site and the duration of the remedy. So you're spending money now to save money somewhere far in the future, and trying to quantify the change in duration of the remediation, therefore the change in perhaps cost, is very difficult, usually involves modeling, and often has big error bars. So that makes the decision, you know, even more difficult. Let's go now to slide 13, and I just want to look forward here, you know, with a few observations, and you know, as I mentioned before, I think one of the big things that we're going to deal with more and more with optimization and our remedies in general going forward is just dealing with the aging infrastructure that I mentioned before. And again, sometimes replacement of equipment may be a good opportunity to maybe change your overall approach to the site. Might be a good time to do that. And in other cases, we may have sites that are quite mature, but where the concentrations that we're observing have plateaued above our cleanup goal. It's a good reason to again start thinking about something else that may take us to the next step, or to have some alternative management strategies for those plateaued concentrations. I think we need to do a better job of, and I think we will see more of this, looking at other natural attenuation processes, you know, other than aerobic degradation for petroleum hydrocarbons or anaerobic degradation pathways for chlorinated solvents, you know, looking at natural processes that are abiotic, reactive mineral kind of things, or, say, for chlorinated organics, an aerobic co-metabolic pathway. Those kind of things should be characterized. I'm making a lot of recommendations in my optimization studies recently about those very things. We need to get the word out. I think we are going to get the word out, and that's going to become more prevalent going forward. We need to start thinking for these long-term remedies, these large sites with high concentrations that have, you know, centuries of duration to them. We need to think about what climate change may mean to our implemented remedies. I know of at least one site where modeling had evaluated the impact of the projected changes in precipitation in that area on a long-term groundwater pump and treat system. So I think we may see more of that consideration going forward. I think we're at an exciting time for the availability of computational power. We're going to see an increase in the use of more numerical, formal optimization tools and techniques, the availability of high-performance computing and massively parallel cloud-based computing puts into the hands of our project team some tools that can do some really serious number crunching to give us an optimal solution or approach for a particular site, and I think we'll see more of that. Matter of fact, there's been a number of demonstration projects that have been looking at these things, and I point out one research effort under the ESTCP program by Jack Parker, where some optimization modeling has been done in order to optimize the transition in that adaptive management approach, switching between different technologies. When's the best time to do that? So the tools are out there, and our computational tools are available. I think we'll see more of that. If we can go now to slide 14. Just wanted to point out that, you know, some of the things that were old are now kind of new again. So things like pump and treat, you know, pretty much kind of thrown on the waste heap a while back. There's been some interesting things done by Arcadis, for example, looking at aggressive pump and treat, paired extraction and injection, particularly forcing flow perpendicular to geologic fabric or flow directions that can really enhance and speed the remediation of dissolved phase plumes. I'm seeing a lot more consideration of permeability enhancement to aid in the delivery of amendments at in-situ technologies type sites. So making it possible to inject more amendment over a broader area, I think we're going to see more of that growing. And then I think, as I mentioned, it's going to be important that we really develop our next generation of optimization experts. And so I really am pushing for people to find talented young professionals that can be mentored to follow in our footsteps, and that our organizations, whether it's a government agency or a consulting firm or a private firm with a portfolio of sites that they manage, there should be some value placed on technical expertise, and that should be developed. The more sites our young people see, the better they're going to be at that. I think that's the more you see, the better you are. Lastly, and in the second part of this FRTR Presents series, you'll hear another presentation about this, but I think for agencies and companies that have large portfolios of sites, doing, optimization studies at individual sites, and do them in detail at a modest expense, it's going to take a while to look at a lot of sites. So looking for ways to apply optimization concepts to more sites more rapidly and at lower cost is really something I think we're going to see more of. I've been pushing that within the Army, and I think we're going to maybe see some more of that. So something to take note of. So get to the last slide, where I just want to summarize some of the key points here. Is one is that federal agencies have had 20 years of cooperation, collaboration, cross-pollination to come up with some really good optimization ideas and tools that have been shared with the private sector, and I think the industry as a whole has really benefited. I think that our optimization efforts, certainly at the federal level, and I think at other levels too, have really had an impact, and I think that's a good take-home message. I think that optimization has changed as our technologies have developed and our industry has changed, but it's still got a good role in improving what we do out there. And then I think that agencies and probably companies do too need to look forward to making sure that we have the human resources that we need to do these kind of optimization studies in the future, and to apply them maybe more rapidly at more sites in their portfolios. So with that, I'd like to take questions.
Okay, we have just enough time for a couple of questions. I want to remind you to type your questions down in that Q&A pod down in the lower right-hand side of your screen. Thank you, Dave. The first question I have for you, I have a participant who would like to know if you could comment on if you've seen co-generated contaminants that influence transport properties, such as VOCs affecting radionuclide transport within your optimization studies?
I've done some work at DOE sites, where we had some mixed waste. I'm not sure that I saw any influence on their transport properties. I'm kind of interested in, just kind of as a side note to this question, interested in the interaction of the radioactive decay products with the contaminants, the other contaminants. There's some indication that there may be some very slow but measurable impacts there. But, I have seen, co-disposed contaminants having an effect more where you have petroleum hydrocarbons disposed of with chlorinated solvents, and so the chlorinateds are actually in an oily hydrocarbon napple with kind of a variable density that's affected their transport. That's made for some difficult cleanups. One site that I'm working on now is definitely an issue there. Not sure if I'm getting at the heart of that question, though. Maybe they can ask a follow-up if there is something else.
Or take it offline.
Yeah, or take it offline. Good point, Kirby. Cindy, were there any other questions? I'm looking at the...
Yes, Dave, I have one more question for you. Can you discuss if you did, as part of your optimization studies, did you have a survey to decide on closure and future use? And if you did, what are the aspects for the monitoring program? What are special aspects for the monitoring program for the final survey?
Okay, I'm trying to figure that one out. Can you repeat that question, the first part of that question again? A survey?
Yes. Would you do a type of survey on an optimization project for a site to determine what the closure and future use will be of that site?
Oh, okay. Got it.
What kind of aspects do you look at for that?
Yeah. No, we certainly ask the questions of the project team and the project manager or you know, the person responsible. What is the ultimate end use for that property and take that into consideration in terms of our recommendations. You know, that certainly affects time frame and exposure routes and those kind of things. So we're, you know, it's you know, a line of questioning, often informal during a site visit that we, you know, get at those kind of things. And then, you know, when we're looking at the monitoring program that's currently in place there, you know, we consider those kind of things. Certainly, you know, future land use can impact monitoring networks. You know, buildings over the top of monitoring points have happened, and then making sure you have the right monitoring to address any potential future exposure because of site land use changes or nearby developments or pumping or those kind of things. You have to be flexible. Hopefully, I'm getting at the gist of that question.
Yes, I think that's it. And that's all the questions that we have time for right now. But again, I want to remind people that if you have more questions, go ahead and submit those. We'll provide them to the speakers, and they can follow up with you later on. And thank you again, Dave, for the presentation. And with that, we're going to move on to Kirby Biggs. There's not enough time to go through all of Kirby's work history here. he's been with EPA for quite a while. He's currently with the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division of the Superfund Office, where he's the National Optimization Program Manager. He's leading the National Optimization Team of headquarters and regional staff, working on multiple site-specific optimization projects involving EPA headquarters, regions, states, and public sector entities conducting Superfund technical support projects throughout the Superfund pipeline using targeted investigation technical support, independent design reviews, remedial systems evaluations, and long-term monitoring and optimization studies. Kirby also sponsors development of optimization internet seminars and delivers webinars and classroom optimization courses. He identifies and develops new techniques, methods, procedures, and practices to facilitate the closeout of sites and to return them to productive use. Kirby, go ahead, please, and start your presentation.
Wow, I'm not sure I can live up to my bio here. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the webinar. I think you'll see in my presentation a reflection of what Dave just gave us and validation, verification that is indeed true. Many of the things that he mentioned are actually observable. So in terms of the team, I am a member of a team. Ed Gilbert is our team leader here. We just formed an optimization team this past year, consisting of me, Ed Gilbert, Carlos Pachon, Matt Jefferson, and Dina Crumling, who is not part of this particular presentation, but is a valuable and important member of our team. So I just wanted to let you know that we have, in fact, organized in headquarters into a teaming concept. One of the objectives is, in fact, to manifest what Dave mentioned just a few minutes ago, which is bringing other professionals in. I've been doing this for a long time myself. I've been with the program since 2005, either as a co-lead or as a leader in the past 5 years or so. And as Cindy mentioned, I'm reaching my 40th year at EPA, so I'm going to be skedaddling at some point. Today I'm going to talk to you first about the key elements of the Superfund optimization program. We're going to take a look at those, how those have developed, the administrative components. We're going to look at the nature of Superfund remedies, and this is from the remedy selection report. It's the 15th one that's been done. We've had a lot of time to get that good, and you'll see some very interesting slides and graphics from that that also verify what Dave was saying, that is the remedy transition, and these are from statistics. So this is not just an anecdotal remark, instead it's a statistical remark. And then the findings from the 2017 Superfund Optimization Report, we did that last year. You'll be hearing about 61 sites, the various recommendations. We did a very formal follow-up with a report that is now available online at the Clumen Optimization website. And then we're going to talk about some conclusions here. So let me reflect on what Dave just said, which is this is EPA's current working definition of optimization. This is the short version. And that would be a systematic site review by a team of, this is a key, independent technical experts at any phase of the cleanup process. We'll see a slide on that in just a second, but moving through the process, to identify opportunities to improve remedy protectiveness, effectiveness, cost efficiency, and to facilitate progress towards site completion. Now, that's very similar to what Dave put out there. We've been using this particular definition for a long time. There are some adds to it in the national strategy, which was put into place in 9 of 2012. The talk about triad and the use of systematic planning and other things like that that might be useful. Let's move on to the key optimization components. Actually, optimization, the early efforts were at the back end of the process, as Dave mentioned, and the O&M, and we're going to look at a slide pretty soon that suggests why that is the case. When the strategy was put into play in 9 of 2012, the strategy had us merging upstream, that is moving the lessons we've learned in the back end of the process in our early efforts towards the front end of the process with the objective of probably working ourselves out of the job, sort of, because you can't always completely work yourself out of the optimization job. Things still require it later on. But in terms of the intense efforts we've been putting in, perhaps, bringing these lessons to the front end of the process will help obviate the need for some of the back end work. You also see the quadrant chart here on the right. It's the hexagon, and that shows the conceptual site model as at the heart of optimization, that being the key question. If you don't know what's going on with your site, you might be able to clean it up, but it'll be an accident. You have to know enough about it. And we also look at, as Dave mentioned, the exit strategy, the remedy components of the site, whether they're operating holistically together or are they doing their job. We look at the monitoring that's being done. Is that adequate to understand the site? Does it delineate the plumes, and so on and so forth? We look at the data management. This has been a big deal for us throughout much of our optimization time. Sometimes you go to an RPM's office and they still have a big log in the corner of paperwork that they then need to have digitized. So we've done a lot of data management work on that in these optimizations. We've used triad in many of them, systematic planning, dynamic field strategy, real-time measurement, and then green remediation, which is, of course, footprint reduction, climate resiliency. Those are some of the components we look at. We'll see those again in just a minute. We have an actual optimization process. We have a standard operating procedure, 19 or so pages that we follow. This particular chart shows the process leading from the beginning of the request for optimization in the left-hand side at the top, following through a scoping call, going further to a kickoff call, let me pull my pointer up. And then moving into the site visit. After the site visit, we have a specific period of time because this is something I can control, not something that I have a little control over, which is like when I get comments back. We follow the process of the kickoff call, the site visit. We then do a draft report. We do a draft, we take comments on that, vet the comments oftentimes with a call. We'll do a draft final report. Usually we don't do a response to comments document. And then we will, we have the review of the final report, final comments, final vetting. Then the report gets finalized. It then goes into a tracking mode. It goes into the optimization report inventory and tracking tool for follow-up, and that's what we'll be talking about in just a few minutes. So the standardized process, you note that that was 2015 that we finished this chart. We've been using this process for a pretty long time. It works very well. What do optimization reviews result in? We look at six specific things in our optimization reviews. We look at remedy effectiveness and protectiveness, cost reductions. We look at opportunities for cost reductions, including moving to alternative technologies, if that is a meaningful way of doing that. Technical improvements to the remedy, that might mean in an operating system, we might suggest, well, your green sand's not doing anything. You might take that offline. The key part of this, of course, is site closures. How does the site graduate from the NPL? Not just to go to the state, but graduate completely to become whatever it will be after it's finished. And that is the redevelopment potential of the site. You see that as the last one. Green remediation, we are calling that climate resiliency these days, because should the worst events happen, then we're going to need to have our sites hardened, and so we're talking about resiliency of those sites. Three prevalent concepts that are going along in third-party optimization. That's the adaptive site management. Are there things that we can do? Are there pathways that we can follow that will speed the remedy and contribute to the overall remedy, but that are possibly no-brainers that you can do in the beginning of the process? Also, adaptive site management means to us moving in the treatment train notion. If you're asymptotic on your primary treatment train, then you need to move to something else. And sometimes that means an ESD or exception for significant deviations of change to the record of decision. We look at CSM development, as I mentioned. We look at this as a living document. That is, it's not just a Sharpie on a transparency, and then you put that away, and then that's all you've ever done. As a site moves from stage to stage in its life cycle process, the CSM also needs to follow that, because that changes. And the use of alternative technologies and approaches, those are very important to us now, because as Dave mentioned, we have been moving from ex situ to in situ, using injections and doing a variety of other different new technologies. I would call them new in the sense that we are using them new in the hazardous waste field. Many of them have been using other fields and we've been adopting and adapting. Let us look at the accomplishments. We have done a lot of work. You'll notice that in the 97 to 2010 period, that's a 13-year period, we did 94 of those optimization sites. We're running about, you know, six to eight to ten per year. When the strategy in 2010 was decided that we would make a national strategy out of it, and we started the work group, one of the key components was to really pump the volume up of the optimization. So in the 2011 through 17 time period, we've done 155 of those. And 2018 to date was 12. We're way up there now, because you'll notice this is as of May 9th. That was the date of the presentation here. We're up to about 285 sites now. I have done 100 of them myself. And we have lots of information about those. So let's take a look at what have we done to actually institutionalize this waste program's practice. We applied standardized processes to the conflict of interest check, the site engagement form, that's my ticket to ride, people fill that out, that's what do you want, who's involved, what do we need to do. The scoping and kickoff calls are designed to really put a boundary on the scope and breadth of the optimizations. that we do. We do on-site visits. We have an interview guide for our on-site visit that we send out to people beforehand so that they know what we're going to be asking about. The report itself has a standardized format. We'll look at that. We've already seen most of it, the six parts. And it's developed, it's reviewed, it's QC'd this process. We have the optimization report inventory and tracking tool and the optimization project log. The optimization project log is the normal everyday today tracking system that records the scoping call, the kickoff call, the metric parameters that we track to note our completion status for the sites. And the optimization report inventory is our follow-up tracking tool that records the recommendations, the findings, the costs, and follows them up after sometimes, depending on the extent of the optimization, 6 months, a year, and then maybe another year and a half down the road to make sure that the optimization recommendations were meaningful, they were useful, they worked for the people. Our cost estimates were, in fact, correct, and that it's working. And also to ask, is there anything else that optimization needs to help you with? We've identified process improvements to reduce cost and time. We standardize and streamline the report template. It used to be very long reports. Now we have it as no more than 30 pages, usually 15 to 20. It was not uncommon, and so it's much more cut to the chase. The portfolio, Dave mentioned doing multiple sites at one blow, sort of seven at one blow, and we've been doing multiple portfolios down in Region 6 and Region 10. We haven't been doing the kinds of portfolios you'll see Mike Singletary talk about in the following presentation, where they did a very large batch of sites. We've been doing them maybe six at a time. We do the more intensive optimization studies. But we have conducted portfolios earlier on of 30, 35 sites back in the early 2000s. We have involved regional management in optimization. That's really helping because now management knows that we're there. We're coming in. We're looking at a site. All of them are very, very aware of who we are and what our purpose and methods are, and they are very much in favor of that sometimes, as opposed to the RPM, because usually we ask our remedial project managers, they're the ones that come to us and they say we need some help. Sometimes management is saying, well, we would like help on this particular site. The other thing is the staffing realities that we have. I think most of you know that the size of the agency has diminished significantly recently, and the availability of staff has been further constrained from that. So the availability of the contract resources that are deployed by the optimization program to support programmatic activities in the regions has turned out to be a very important recent development. And other programs are adapting. Our OUST program looked at seven tribal sites using our optimization resources and now do some optimizations on their own. We are currently working with the RCRA Lean RFI process, RCRA First investigation process, helping to learn from them what they are learning about their RCRA First process, which, by the way, reduced their number of steps in their process of investigation from, I think, 52 to 19 or 17, a very significant reduction. We're looking at the back end of the process and working with them to see what we can do to help them. Regions and optimization, I have a number of my regions now leading optimizations, Region 10 particularly, Region 6, Region 1, my optimization liaisons, which I have one for each region. That is my regional contact person. I do lead their own with my resources. And providing a broad network of optimization support, we have probably six or maybe seven contractor sources that we can resource, one to avoid COI. So if one firm is COI on a project, the other one can take it up. And remedial action contractors, I've been using them, bought into those racks. Support from USACE, Dave Becker and I, Dave, the grandfather of optimization, and I have a cooperative interagency agreement that, and I use Dave pretty regularly to do optimizations for us. Particularly, we've been branching out into some federal facilities recently. Let us look for a moment at the Superfund Task Force. As most of you are probably familiar, this task force was put into play and as soon as the administration came in. This is another version of every administration wants to put their mark on Superfund. There's been the Integrated Cleanup Initiative, the One EPA Initiative. There have been the Superfund reforms. There have been many, many things. And now there are the Superfund work group and Superfund task force recommendations. Luckily, adaptive management is recommendation 3. Recommendation 7 is third-party independent optimization reviews. That's us here in the optimization program. So we feel very fortunate that the value of the work that we've been doing over the past 20 years has been called out here specifically by the task force, and a recommendation has been made to pump up the volume on that. We have declared victory on optimization recommendation number 7, that being we've done 18 sites under that. We are in the process of completing those sites. We brought the lessons learned to those. We developed a strategic method for picking them out that focuses on worst sites first, sites of great complexity, sites with human exposure not under control, sites with groundwater migration not under control, sites which have large redevelopment potential. So we developed a set of metrics to ascertain more valuable sites for optimization. And you see the 2017 optimization evaluations. This is kind of a typical year, carryover projects from the previous year. We start a set of new projects. In this case, it's 35 in FY17. We completed 25, so we had some carryover and carrying them forward. And then we totally active projects in 17 were 71. And that's both optimization and technical support. We do larger and smaller pieces of work. Let us look at, in this section, remedy selection as a driver for optimization. The information in this section comes from the 17th remedy, the 2017, excuse me, remedy selection report. That's the 15th one we've done. We're going to look at the number of COCs, remedy selection review, the pump and treat versus various other remedies. This follows on Dave's information, and we're going to look at the transitions. Let's move towards that. COCs, very interesting here. This is about 100% of, we're talking about a lot of sites here, 1,100 that have metals, 1,100 that have VOCs, almost the same number with SVOCs, and then there's a small amount of others. Interestingly, in this 25% right here, these are individuals. Metals, 149, VOCs, about the same number. SVOCs, about a third or so. The next interesting category, combined VOCs, metals, VOCs, SVOCs, and SVOC metals. Again, very similar numbers, SVOCs and metals, VOCs and SVOCs, virtually the same, and also very much the same for SVOCs and metals. Not much difference. And then ones with all of them is about 53% or 737 of these sites. And then there's a very, very small fragment in the 9 sites which have other. So usually there are mixed contaminants. What does that mean? Usually that means mixed technologies that you have to use. Let's look quickly at a number of sites here. This is 1,540 sites, a very large population, looking at 1982 82 from 20 through 2014. For non-treatment, there's NA or NFA. That's 344 sites, or 22% of that. There were 78 with treatment. And let us look at the treatment. 18% with source control, groundwater and source, 42. Groundwater alone, 18. So the biggest chunk of them, 78%. And then there's a scattering of others here. NA, NFA, and then there are groundwater containment with multiple activities, and then the next smaller sources, the source container disposed of is 12%. Of course, that's the big chunk of that particular segment. Let us look further now at P&T selection. Now, this is the one where Dave was saying, well, we thought P&T for a while was the magic bullet, and you can see that here, is that during in the very early parts of the process, 85 through through 90, and all the way into 90 or so, 91, there were a huge number of pump and treat systems selected. That's because we thought they were all going to be working, and we found that, well, they didn't exactly work as much as we were thinking. We were hoping that they would work better. And so the question began to be asked, why? Why would they not be working better? And so that's where optimization first started to come into this process, looking at that. And you can see that the pump and treat systems are dropping. We're going to look at another chart in just a minute that shows the increase in other technology. But what I did want to point out is that we still select a lot of these, and even though by 95 the numbers dropped, let us look at 82 through 2014, a longer period of time for groundwater. There's the two segments we'll be looking at here are pump and treat with source control, and that would be actually 61% are pump and treat with source control and on-site containment. And 10% only with pump and source treatment, although that number is increasing now, as Dave mentioned. Pump and treat with source contaminant or disposal, containment rather, or disposal is 15. And then looking further along here in the smaller segments, you see a mixture, P&T in situ treatment, P&T in M&A, and then P&T in situ treatment and M&A, and then P&T only 9% of those that are not mixed remedies. So you can see why there was a need to have optimization and why it started at the back end of the process. Let us look at the trends here. Now, this is going to be the spaghetti chart, so get ready. This is in situ treatment. You'll see that there's a clear trending upwards through 2014, which is when this stops. Little drop off between 13 and 14, but a negligible in terms of the whole scale of the thing. Next, let's look at pump and treat. Well, you know, I said that it was going down. Well, it is going down, and it did go down. It popped back up again, and then it's being used more sparingly, but as Dave mentioned, it's being used in combination with more high-resolution characterization activities that make it more available to selectively pull contaminants out of from under the ground. This is ICs, institutional controls. You can see a big bump up in the institutional controls in the late 80s and early, I'm sorry, the 90s, late 80s and early 90s. That was when the Management Assistance Group for Institutional Controls, the MAGIC group, went out and did a lot of work, and it's only been going up since then. I think a very huge chunk of the cleanups these days have institutional controls of some nature or another. I think we've done a very good job at that. Let us look now at MNA, Well, that was not looked on very favorably in the beginning of the process, but as we found over the course of the years, it's useful. It's fallen out of popularity. You look at the 2002 time frame, up and down. Not sure why these swings are happening. I think partly it's due to its, like I said, its popularity, and it's the view as to whether it's actually a way to do it. I think we do not believe that that is the case. So we'll probably continue to see a bounce around like this. Last two things are alternative water supplies and vertically engineered barriers. That's that bottom red line is the blue, is the vertically engineered barriers. And you can see that that's been bouncing around up and down, the slurry walls and things like that, that we still continue to use as a sort of a regular feature. The provision of alternative water supplies has decreased and then sort of has plateaued. So a very interesting set of trends for optimization, and a way to see that optimization has been following sort of this trajectory. That is, oftentimes we will recommend bioengineered barriers or other alternative technologies. Let us turn now to the optimization strategy update. Now, this is the National Optimization Project Progress Report. This is our report card. We had a very good report card, I'm very happy to say. We did expand the program. Now we have about 50 ongoing optimization events per year and 20 to 25 completed per year. And I mentioned that we were moving from the back end of the process to the front end of the process. Only 14% are in O&M. Some of those are actually state O&Ms, where we will come in and help the state for a site that is still lingering in their portfolio from our MPL. In the remedial action, we still are at 50% of that. We've moved back up to pre-remedial action at 35%. This is the thing I really like here. 64% of the recommendations of these 61 sites, 645 recommendations, we'll see that statistic in just a minute. They're either implemented, in progress, or planned. Another 15% are under consideration. So that's about 80% or so that are either done, planned, or either done, underway, planned, or anticipated. And then only 16% are declined. And we'll take a look at those numbers more closely in just a minute. Fully 68% showed improvements to the CSM. 60%. All right, is everybody still there? Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I thought I may have lost people. Sorry about that. Thank you. And then 39% had improved system engineering, 36% change in remedial approach. And we did technical support. I mentioned we do both optimizations and technical support for a number of events. Here's a different take on these. This is the 645 recommendations from the 61 sites. Effectiveness, 273. Cost reduction, 152. Again, these are the standard optimization report look at areas, the metrics. Technical improvement, site closure, you can read these numbers yourself. Green remediation, 132. A total of 722 recommendations. Some recommendations are in more than one group. Here's another way of looking at this. This is looking at the tools and techniques that we implemented. When we looked at these 61 sites, we looked at what were the things that we found that we looked at. This is just an historical perspective and historical perspective. And that would be the CSM requirements. We looked at fully 68% of the sites we had CSM recommendations for. 60% of the sites had streamlined or improved monitoring. That's something that we almost always find is data gaps and monitoring. Improvements that can be made that really reveal a lot more about the site. We're talking about 39% with improved system engineering, another 36%, changes for remedial action approach, that would sometimes generate an exception for significant deviations, or ROD amendments, moving from one technology to another. The use of strategic sampling is increasing all the time, and improved data management, as I mentioned, that's one of our focus areas, so a full chunk of those got improved data management, and the use of combined remedies, where we would recommend yet another remedy or a modification to a remedy in 8% of those cases. Let's take a quick look. Implemented, again, this is another look at the same thing, so I'm going to go quickly through this. So implemented, 293. In progress, 76%. Planned, 7%. That means that they're going to be doing it. They're thinking about it in another 15%. And then we deferred to the state. If the state was in the operation and maintenance business, the recommendations would be deferred to them. Declined. You might say, wow, declined? Why would they do that? Well, oftentimes in an optimization report, we will describe two paths forward, a path A and a path B. Path A has recommendations. Path B has recommendations. If you take path A, you don't do the path B recommendations. So even in some of these declined recommendations, a number of them fall into that category of not relevant. And then there's a small unidentified fraction. Let me continue to push on through here. Okay, this is just looking at another piece of this. Same numbers, 14% in O&M, remedial action 37. And the key thing here is the pre-remedial is we're up to 25% now, 21 and 14% in RIFS and design, respectively. Okay, let me quickly talk about a new development going on here. I know I'm running a little bit low on time, so I'm going to go on through quickly. We have the remedial action framework. This is our new contract mechanism that we're going to be going to national contracts, the three design and engineering services, remediation, environmental services contract, that's the remediation act, the RA contract, and the environmental services and operations. In each of these contracts, there are similar language that is requiring optimization that the contractor shall consider and, to the extent requested by EPA, apply optimization activities for all contract activities. We haven't figured out exactly how this is going to work yet, but we believe that that's going to generate self-optimization to a large extent, and we're hoping for that. And then, again, the similar requirements for the third-party optimization activities, third-party optimization activities on projects that they are executing as requested. Let's take a quick look here, just to reflect back on Dave's comments. This is a very old chart, and it's probably not quite up to date, but there is optimization policy I think, except for DOE, although they have a lot of optimization work going on. So each of us in the services has our own optimization approach, which is very, very, very similar. And I wanted to just show collaterally here that we are all working collectively on our optimization. Let me conclude by just saying that optimization is a very mature effort. We've done, my boss Dan Powell and I have done we're both public administrators, and we've done a lot of public administration to standardize the process, to make it underpinned with the actual infrastructure that one needs to operate a government program. And we are moving that program, disseminating it from headquarters, distributing it down into our regional offices, and seeking to improve our contractors' abilities to produce optimizations, independent self-optimization. We're looking, we're acting on our findings. Dave was saying how he goes out and he hears how people did the work, and he's really happy. Well, we are too, and we can prove it. because we have a report where we've done a statistical analysis of this. And again, we're seeing remedy effectiveness increases, very significant benefits in that. Cost reductions, I can confidently say that I have saved hundreds of millions of dollars, or the optimization program has, for EPA. One site alone, I saved $19 million on. Another site, I saved $9 million. My program has cost about $11 million since 1997 when it started. And in that one site, I paid for my entire program. So I'm pretty happy about that. We have made significant technical improvements. We have actually closed sites. The Groveland, we've shut off the pump and treat there. That one may eventually retire, but we have made some significant advances in some sites in really moving them along. And I don't want to forget about what we call green remediation or footprint reduction, because that's going to be very important later on in our lifetimes. And we're going forward, we're not expecting optimization to do anything but have continued support, greater integration, growing. That's our intention. And we just want to, I just want to point out that the task force did recognize many of the great works that all of us, that's Dave Becker, Mike Singletary, Kent Glover, the EPA people, have been doing over the years in developing our new and very spiffy techniques. So let's see. With that, let me just say that there are plenty of resources. You can go to cluein.org/optimization. We've got a report there. We've got review guides. We've got site-specific reports. We've got summary progress reports on implementation. That's the report, the annual report I was talking about. And then Superfund remedy report, that is actually on another page in the cluein.org website. And you can reach it through that if you have a interest in that. And if you want to talk to me, you can call me at this number, or you can write me at this address. And let me just go ahead and say, and then again, there's the epa.gov/superfund. Look for optimization there. There's an actual epa.gov page. And then the cluein.org page, you can reference that back and forth to epa.gov. With that, let me open the floor for questions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Kirby. If we have some more time for questions at the end, we will take those. You guys can go ahead and type them into the Q&A pod, but for now, I'm afraid we need to move on to our next speaker. Our next speaker is Michael Singletary. Mr. Singletary is a registered professional engineer with 20 years of federal and private sector experience in soil and groundwater remediation and environmental engineering. He supervises, designs, and implements site characterization and restoration programs addressing the requirements of a variety of regulatory programs, including CERCLA, RCRA, and state environmental cleanup programs. And he collaborates with the scientific and engineering community to conduct applied research on innovative soil and groundwater remediation technologies and to develop and promote state-of-the-practice technologies for site restoration. Mike specializes in contaminant groundwater fate and transport processes, environmental risk management, subsurface remediation of chlorinated solvents and fuel hydrocarbons, bioremediation technologies, and molecular biological tools. Mike, I'll let you start your presentation. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy, and thanks for inviting me to give this presentation on the Navy's portfolio optimization work that we've been doing over the last 3 years. I want to acknowledge Gennady Coghlan and Arun Gavaskar and a whole host of subject matter experts within the Navy that have been working on this program for the last 3 years, and we'll be doing additional rounds of these portfolio reviews. So I'm going to focus on the first round that we've done, and as Dave and Kirby alluded to in the optimization overview, you know, the focus of these portfolio reviews is to shift the focus from the individual site and look at groupings of sites or multiple sites, and hopefully from that we can draw on certain common findings and themes that we can use then to drive, you know, future optimization efforts and also policy and guidance and training for our RPMs. And so that's what we've attempted to do with this first round. Today's presentation is really in the context of complex sites. The sites that we looked at were really targeting the complicated, you know, sites, large chlorinated solvent sites, large LNAPL sites. And we base those selections on cost to complete, or the total life cycle cost, as well as the remediation time frame. And those ended up being pretty good proxies for, you know, picking out this subset of complex sites. So I'll talk about these sites and the challenges they pose to the Navy's cleanup program. And then finally, I'm going to touch a little bit on adaptive site management. You've heard that term, or adaptive management. You've heard that mentioned in the previous two speakers. And I talk a little bit about it and give, I think, an example of a site where we've done some adaptive site management concepts, even though we weren't necessarily, you know, started out under that framework, but we've sort of adapted and optimized the site over a long period of time. And so I think it'll give some examples of some of these concepts for adaptive site management. Okay, so I just covered that on my... when I was talking there, but the site that I'm going to talk about is in Texas, former MWRP McGregor. So I'll start out just to give you a brief overview of the guidance that we had. Dave did a really good job of sort of outlining the optimization, the history that went into the federal facilities, the DoD services, and other government agencies in the late 90s and early 2000s. The Navy developed guidance documents starting about that time. We have three different guidance documents, one for optimizing remedy selection, optimizing remedial action operation, and then optimizing long-term monitoring and management. And then we also have an overall policy for optimizing remedial actions at Navy sites. And that policy first came out in 2004, and we've updated it over the years to incorporate new concepts such as green remediation, and now with this new portfolio round of reviews that we're doing as well. This slide gives you a snapshot of our cost to complete, or CTC, and this is basically the life cycle cost for the Navy's environmental entire environmental restoration program. So the large pie chart on the left represents the total cost breakdown. And so our program is about a $4.5 billion program. And if you, the smaller pie charts on the right, it's broken down by IRP, which is Installation and Restoration Program. That's traditional soil and groundwater type contamination, which is what I'm really going to focus on today. But it also includes the Munitions Response Program. And so the breakout of costs for those two programs is roughly $2.5 billion for the IRP, and then about $2 billion for the MRP, so in total of $4.5 billion program. In terms of the total number of sites, again, the chart on the left shows the sites for the overall program, including the munition sites. But if you look at the pie chart on the top right, that shows just the IRP sites. And so what's interesting from this chart is that, you know, the blue and the green represent sites where we've already achieved site closeout, which is a cleanup endpoint to unrestricted use, or to response complete, which typically involves closure with some form of institutional control on the property. And so if you total those up, that's, you know, about 86% of all of the sites. So what we're left with at this point is this subset of sites that are in active cleanup or long-term monitoring or remedial action operation. And that's about 13.5%. So, you know, we've made a lot of progress in getting to closure, but these last sites in this last 13.5% or so, it's about 550 sites, really represent a couple of different baskets of sites. One are the complex sites that we know we're going to be doing long-term management on. And then there are also some newer sites that are coming into the program that are lower risk in the way that we sequence the initial work in the EARN program. We address the high-risk sites first. So there are some lower-risk sites that are accounted for in that 13.5%. But most of the funding and most of the sites are what I would consider to be more complex sites. All right, so we've heard a lot, or we're hearing more about, you know, quote-unquote complex sites and, you know, what exactly that means and how you define those. Folks have different, you know, interpretations. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, at least for the Navy's program, most of our straightforward sites have been addressed largely. We've been able to close those out either under an unrestricted land use scenario, or if we need to put institutional controls, we have that ability as well. So where we're devoting our funding and our resources now are really on these larger complex sites that we're going to have to manage, you know, over a longer period of time. And a lot of what we've found in our own program mirrors what was reported in 2013 as part of the National Research Council report on sort of the state of the nation's cleanup program, where they estimate, you know, roughly 10% of the sites, again, are, you know, quote-unquote complex. And that definition of complex really means that they're not going to meet cleanup objectives in a reasonable time frame. And the cost to remediate all of those sites across the nation, they estimate to be around $127 billion. But again, I think the bottom line is that for these complex sites, we need to be thinking about alternative ways to manage those over the long term. And so things like adaptive site management, you know, appear to be a reasonable approach to take for these sites. A couple of quotes from that document that I think definitely apply to the Navy's cleanup program in terms of achieving site closure. The document states that, you know, meeting the DoD's ambitious programmatic goals of remedy in place and response complete appear to be unlikely, and site closure may even be an impossibility at some of these sites. And then also, you know, the nation's cleanup program appears to be transitioning from remedy selection into remedy operation and long-term management, potentially over long time frames. You know, this is decades of long-term management that we'll have to implement for these types of sites. So what makes these sites so challenging? This chart is actually pulled from an ITRC online document that a team was formed to look at how to manage these complex sites. And I think most of us are familiar with the technical challenges, things like, you know, the presence of DNAPL and LNAPL at sites, hydrogeologic factors, the ability of these contaminants to diffuse and to store into low permeability media, and how that impacts our ability to achieve, stringent groundwater cleanup goals over time. But I think also these non-technical challenges play a big role too. You know, when you have multiple regulators and stakeholders involved, and you're all trying to reach an agreement on a remedy for a site, that is a challenge. And also within DoD and other institutions, you know, property changes hands. You can either sell property off to the private sector, we can transfer land over to local municipalities, and so the ability to manage that risk, ensure we have the right kind of institutional controls, is another set of challenges. So I'll leave that chart for you to study at your convenience. So we've heard a lot about adaptive site management. As Kirby mentioned, EPA, the Superfund Task Force, has a pilot program that they're implementing starting this year, where they're looking for example sites across the EPA regions, where they'll be, you know, using sites and using this adaptive site management process to help in decision making. So it'd be very interesting to see what comes out of that, what kind of good case study examples that they can share with the rest of us, so that we can see sort of what adaptive site management looks like, you know, both on paper in terms of guidance, but also, you know, in good field examples. I just want to point out with this slide that this concept is nothing new. I think we've all done some adaptive site management on our projects, particularly those that last, you know, for long periods of time. We're always optimizing, updating our conceptual site model. And those are really, I think, you know, a couple of the key components to adaptive management. And in fact, in 2003, another NRC report identified this process as a good way for the Navy to manage their own site. So I think in some ways we've been doing this, but it'll be nice to get a little bit more definitive guidance out so that we can all, you know, be on the same page. All right, so moving into the portfolio review. Again, this process for us started back in 2015. We looked at approximately over, I think there were 32 or 33 sites in total that we looked at. About two-thirds of those were sites where in situ remedies had been implemented. These were typically treatment trains that were used on chlorinated solvent sites, and we also had some larger LNAPL sites. And then the other one-third of the sites were pump and treat systems. So we had about a dozen pump and treat systems where we were looking at, you know, optimizing those sites as well. We did this through a combination of Navy subject matter experts, and also we teamed up with some outside private consultants who had experience with other government agencies as well as the private sector, and that was a good feedback mechanism for us to make sure that some of our recommendations were grounded with sort of the state of the practice outside of the Navy. So that was a valuable component to our team as well. We developed both detailed site-specific findings for each individual site, and we shared those with the RPMs and the regional management, and we also assisted RPMs in implementing those recommendations with their project teams. But we also were trying to develop some larger portfolio-wide themes that we could use to focus future optimization efforts and also provide training and guidance for RPMs on specific issues. And we've identified several of those over the last 3 years and through our own RITS training seminars as well as some policy and guidance. We've been able to communicate that out to our RPMs. Okay, so these are the sites. This is just a listing and a chart showing some of the sites that we looked at. These are the in-situ sites. 21 of these are in total, and the blue bars represent the cost to complete. So this would be, the cost to complete the entire life cycle for the project. So for most of these sites, that ranged from, up to $5 million, but we did have some sites that were in the $10 to $20 million range as well. And then the red dots represent the remediation time frame. And for most of these sites, that was estimated at greater than 30 years. And where detailed modeling had been done, that could have been 50 or even 100 years in some cases. So these were sites that all had very long time frames associated with them. So summary of our findings, again, these were all sites with very long time frames. Typically these sites, I think Kirby talked about earlier, we typically saw these implemented as treatment trains. So there would be a source reduction technology implemented to try to reduce the source area concentrations, bioremediation or ISCO, and then that was typically coupled with something to manage the downgradient plume. May have been a hotspot treatment for another portion of the plume or even a barrier to try to cut or intercept a part of a plume from leaving a property or further expanding. And then with all of these sites, there was an M&A component that was going to be relied on for being the component that would be used to attain the final cleanup goal, which for these sites was typically the MCL or some risk-based standard. So one of our initial goals was to try to identify sites that we could accelerate the cleanup timeframe. One of our metrics within the Navy is to try to achieve 95% response complete at our sites by the year 2021. And so one of our goals was to try to identify some sites that we could bring into that timeframe. And unfortunately, we didn't find any that we felt like through additional aggressive treatment we could meet those MCL type objectives. But what we did find on several sites were areas where we could do additional aggressive treatment and make meaningful impacts on actual risk reduction. A couple of examples are sites where vapor intrusion was identified as a potential receptor. We were able to go in and do aggressive treatment to try to manage or mitigate that exposure pathway. And likewise, we had some sites where plumes were discharging into surface water, and we could go in and take immediate actions to address that. So we could still make meaningful risk reduction through additional action, but not necessarily shorten the overall remediation time frame. So that's a distinction, but yet we don't want to lose the fact that we still did have some successes in terms of shifting our resources into different areas. We found that long-term management and monitoring were really what were driving these costs. Even a small amount of money, if you add that up over 50, you know, 30 to 50 or more years, that adds up. Particularly for the DoD, we're unable to discount those out-year costs. So those are costs that are going to stay the same without optimization. You know, those will stay constant over time, and so those costs typically add up. And then finally, you know, and I think of an important area of future work is this idea of these transition assessments. We found a number of sites where the project teams were uncertain when to go from aggressive treatment to something more passive like M&A or some other type of technology. So that transition assessment is an important thing that's, I think, lacking in a lot of the tools that are out there. Okay, some of the key site management questions that we use as part of this process to guide us in making these decisions and to focusing our resources on certain sites are listed here. If you look at these questions, they're kind of a very simplified decision framework almost. You know, the first question we asked was, you know, is there an ongoing actual impact to receptors? You know, I used the vapor intrusion example before. That's a good one. You know, if those that receptors were identified, then we needed to take more immediate action to try to control that risk or to control that pathway. If those immediate impacts did not exist, then the next question was, well, what about the plume? Is it stable? Is it, you know, leaving our property? And if it was, then, you know, that was another area where we felt like we needed to step in and do things like, you know, installing a treatment barrier or, worst case, a pump and treat system or something to try to control the expansion of that plume. But then if the plume was stable, then another set of questions were, well, what's controlling the stability of that plume? Is it a natural process? And if so, we need to understand those processes and ensure their sustainability over a long time frame. In other words, if there's a reductive dechlorination reaction going on, are we going to be able to rely on that process to occur for, you know, decades? On the flip side, if a mechanic or an engineered system was being used to control the plume stability, we need to make sure that we have the right kind of life cycle design, operation, and maintenance that can handle that process over the long term. So these were some of the key site management questions that we identified as we went through these sites. All right, I'm going to go through these key messages. This is a review, and then I'm going to get into the site example to wrap up the presentation. So some of these key messages, again, you know, there are this subset of sites out there, complex sites, ones that are really going to drive resource allocation and our attention in the coming, you know, decades for this type of work. You know, we definitely identified a subset of those, and we're putting policy and guidance in place on how to manage those types of sites. Again, adaptive site management appears to be, at this point, the most suitable approach to try to manage these types of sites, and really to try to manage that uncertainty by using this iterative process that relies on multiple, you know, feedback loops and mechanisms. We can continuously update that conceptual site model, and that will give us the ability to guide our decision making. Again, for these sites, long-term passive management appears to be an appropriate long-term goal or endpoint for these complex sites. Obviously, we want to focus our initial efforts on sites where there's uncontrolled risk, but those long-term goals of the MCL being attained, that's typically going to happen through natural attenuation, and again, that may take a fairly long, you know, decades to achieve. But in the interim, we need to have a robust set of institutional controls so that we can prevent exposure on these sites. And then, obviously, we're continuously doing optimization and updating the conceptual site model throughout that process. So to go along with that long time frame, interim goals are very important. And this was one of the recommendations out of the ITRC document. And I think it makes perfect sense. If you've got a decades-long site that you're managing, it's perfectly reasonable for regulators and other stakeholders to want to see interim goals so that they can monitor and track the progress of the site. And so we've developed some goals, and there's different ways of thinking about and looking at these interim transition goals. They may be concentration-based, they may be flux-based, they may be just as simple as ensuring that the that there's no uncontrolled exposure pathways at a site. I mean, that's a huge interim goal that needs to be met. And so those need to be incorporated into decision documents and agreed upon with the teams. And then finally, I mentioned the transition assessments. I think these are important. And I know ESDCP and CERTIP are interested in trying to develop some tools to support adaptive site management, and these transition assessments sort of fit in that mold as well. So hopefully we'll get more of these tools that are available for RPMs so that they can do these assessments and make sure that we're doing things in an effective and efficient way. All right, so I'm going to wrap up with just an example of a site that I've been working on for a while, and we've done, you know, a lot of optimization over a long time period here, and I think we've incorporated some of those ASM type or adaptive management concepts. This is a site in McGregor, Texas. It's a Naval Weapons Industrial Reserve Plant. So these are government-owned and contractor-operated, or GOCO, facilities. This one operated until 1995, and it was used to manufacture rocket motors and bombs, through that process released a lot of perchlorate to the environment, as well as chlorinated solvents, but perchlorate was the real risk driver here. This is a huge facility, almost 10,000 acres in a rural area outside of Waco, Texas. And the current use of the property, there's several different industrial and agricultural companies that have moved in and are doing work in this area, including SpaceX. They actually have a pretty large training and a launch facility at the site. The Navy does maintain all of the cleanup and liability for the environmental restoration impacts. We have lease agreements that we go in and do work as part of our Navy cleanup program. This is a map, again, just showing the size of the area. I'm going to be focusing in on the don't know if I can get the arrow to come up, but in this southwestern part of the area, the area shaded in gray is called Area M, and that's the site of the example that I'm going to go over today. Okay, I mentioned we've been doing a lot of optimization here, life cycle optimization. We started back in the early 2000s looking at optimizing a fluidized bed reactor. We had a pump and treat system that is operated here, and we tried to add some automation and remote monitoring for the FBR. That was done in the early 2000s. We've been doing long-term monitoring optimization over time, but our efforts lately have shifted toward trying to think of exit strategies and closure strategies for the site. So we've developed a conceptual model of the natural attenuation capacity of the groundwater to surface water system at the site to address the low-level perchlorate that's found at this site. You know, think of tens to low hundreds of parts per billion. There's an ability for this site to attenuate that through a variety of mechanisms, and I'll show a slide that goes over that in a minute. We've also been able to work with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, or TCEQ, to change the reclassify the groundwater system out here, which gives us a not as stringent cleanup goal for the site. That was done in 2016. We also did some risk assessments looking at ecological receptors and their exposure to perchlorate and surface water. And then finally, we're working on transitioning the groundwater pump and treat system with the fluidized bed reactor from an above-ground pump and treat system to a series of passive in-situ biobarriers. And that's sort of where we are right now with this process. This is an aerial view of the site. Again, we're down in the sort of this part of the base here. These blue lines represent trenches that were cut into the ground, you know, anywhere from 30 to 40 feet below grade, and they're used to collect groundwater, and they're cut both parallel and perpendicular to the groundwater flow velocity. So we intentionally did this to try to collect the water before it left the property boundary, which is the maroon line along the bottom, and also before it discharged into this receiving tributary located along here. So again, that system's been running since the early 2000s, I think 2001, 2002 timeframe. And it is a challenge from an operation and maintenance standpoint in terms of what it takes to keep this system running. I mentioned the groundwater surface water interactions at this site. This is a relatively dry part of the state, but there are a lot of precipitation occurs in the spring, and it creates this dynamic effect where we get ephemeral tributaries and streams that form during the wet season, and then those dry out over time. And so you can think of this dynamic movement of the water table up and down that creates this mixing process that can occur, and we've been able to demonstrate that it does attenuate the perchlorate concentrations over time, particularly downgradient as you get more into the downgradient watershed. And so that's an important aspect of this conceptual site model. These are photos of the above ground treatment system. Again, you can see the lagoons located here. This is a fairly large area. These lagoons are to store water during wet portions of the season, and then that water is then pumped into this fluidized bed reactor where it's used to treat the perchlorate through a biological reaction, and then we discharge the water into the tributary that I showed earlier. This plot here shows the perchlorate concentrations going into the pump and treat system. So this is before treatment, and what it's meant to show is the, you know, roughly order of magnitude reduction in perchlorate over time. So you can see, you know, through a combination of source reduction, we did a lot of excavation and removal of contaminated soil, but also this natural flushing process that I mentioned, we've seen a significant reduction in what's heading into the fluidized bed reactor. And so we're at a point now where we're thinking of transitioning the pump and treat system to something more passive that we can manage over a longer period of time with a little bit more ease in terms of operation and maintenance, and also at a lower cost. And so our goal is to shut the system down and transition it over to a series of biobarriers. We're working with the TCEQ to do this. We have done a pilot study. You can see this plot here shows the change in concentration in perchlorate in 2001 compared to 2018. So you can see through our remedial efforts, we've made a significant impact on the plume here. This large area is about 10,000 parts per billion. That has been reduced in size to the smaller area here. And then this is where we're going to focus that biobarrier portion of the remedy moving forward. And we've done some pilot testing. And it appears that this will be an effective way to treat the contamination in situ. You can see the plot here on the right is an upgradient well where we have perchlorate, you know, greater than 10,000 parts per billion that stays relatively constant. But in our downgradient well, after we injected the emulsified oil into the bio barrier or the bio wells, we saw a significant reduction, you know, almost three orders of magnitude in perchlorate, as well as some nitrate that's present out here. So again, this appears to be a viable technique moving forward, and so this is something that we're going to be working with our regulators and other stakeholders as we transition moving forward. One last thing I want to bring up, and I mentioned it earlier, is that we were able to work with TCEQ to reclassify this groundwater system, and this is a key aspect here because Texas allows, this is done under a RCRA post-closure order. They allowed groundwater standards for both residential use of groundwater as well as commercial industrial. And by reclassifying this groundwater to Class 3, we were able to increase that number up to around 5,000 parts per billion. So that basically, for the downgradient or off-site portions of our property, we already meet that. So the portion of the site that's above 5,000 is really now more on the former Navy property. And so that helps in managing this going forward. So wrap up here, we're almost out of time. Again, just to kind of reiterate some of the components of this site management process that we've gone through, again, reclassifying the groundwater over time, updating our conceptual site model to include some of these other types of natural attenuation mechanisms, doing a transition assessment, going from pump and treat to an in situ system to treat the remaining perchlorate. And I didn't go into detail, but we also did an ecological risk assessment where we were able to demonstrate that there were no adverse impacts to sensitive receptors from exposure to perchlorate in the downgradient surface water. And so that was another key aspect in terms of risk, making sure that that ecological pathway was not of a concern. And so again, through this process, we feel like this adaptive site management approach will result in significant cost avoidance, but also maintain protection of human health and the environment, and just improve the effectiveness and efficiency of this system. It is aging, it's 15 plus years old, and so it makes sense to transition this on to something that we can get more useful life out of. So with that, I'll end, I'll leave my contact information, my email address, and may have a minute or two for questions, but I'll turn it back over to Cindy to do that.
Thank you, Mike. And I'm afraid we are out of time today. If you do have some questions, you can go ahead and punch those in the Q&A pod, and I'll send those to the speakers for them to follow up with you. But we are coming to the end of our time here. So I just want to let you know, if you found that today's webinar met your needs, I would encourage you to check out the second session of these presentations from this meeting. Those will be delivered on Wednesday, October 17th at 1 p.m. Eastern. And also, we have coming up the next Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable in-person meeting. The fall meeting will be held on November 7th in the USGS headquarters in Reston, Virginia. That meeting will focus on polyfluoral alkyl substances. And the meeting objectives will be to identify and discuss the emerging science between PFAS characterization and remedial technologies, and to share experiences and lessons learned through case studies. You can check out frtr.gov for more info on those. Please feel free to connect with Kluin using social and professional network sites. You'll find Kluin on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can also sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, to learn about new webinars and resources related to hazardous site cleanup. Thank you again for joining today's live webinar. I'd like to remind participants that slides and other items related to today's session can be found on the seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as noted earlier. I also like to ask you to take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, both the content covered and the method of delivery. We don't issue PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, but if you save or print a webinar participation certificate after submitting the feedback, that will be available. Please be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify you were here for the entire event, or if you replayed the event archive. If you don't check that box, you won't get the certificate. You may find that a copy of your registration email, seminar slides, and that feedback confirmation email are enough to document your participation, and will get you your accrediting institution PDHs or CEUs. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out the online feedback form to get their own certificate. This applies to those watching the recorded version of today's session as well. We do look at your comments as we try to continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms, and you can request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. If you need any more assistance, please feel free to contact Jean Ballant. And again, today's session was recorded. In the near future, you'll be able to access these slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive. You'll automatically receive an email once that archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thanks again for joining today's session, and thank you to our speakers. I hope you found this to be a valuable use of your time, and that we'll see you on a future webinar. This is the formal conclusion of today's broadcast.